What fed his prayer life? What of the character and personality that made these prayers? He was an intellectual and yet warm, but with an honest warmth and not just a charming one. Sweet but skeptical, emotional but not sentimental. He was a philosopher whose inquiries and examinations have been called true theological breakthroughs. The American Cardinal Avery Dulles, a widely respected intellectual of the Church, has said that John Paul, quote, holds a special place of eminence, unquote, as a writer and a thinker. And yet he was a common man whose sympathies and background were with the common people. The worker pope, they called him, because he worked with his back in a factory as a young man. He was a traditionalist who held high the great church thinking of the past 2,000 years and insisted its teachings were true and could not be swept away by modern yearnings that the truth be otherwise. And yet he was a progressive thinker who embraced science and the arts and whose thoughts on the origin of the universe were that the Big Bang theory of creation might well be true, that it is not incompatible with the Church's teachings, and that we must continue research and investigation in this area, inviting the world's scientists to understand that if the theory is true, that does not mean it was random or an accident or inevitable. Someone set the Big Bang in motion. Someone made it happen. Someone decreed it. John Paul liked to remind scientists, by the way, that the Big Bang theory was conceived in the mind of a scientist who was also a priest. John Paul adhered to doctrine and yet encouraged dialogue. He loved the faithful and loved to tell them to reach out with love to those who spurn the faith. He held to the ancient teachings of the Church, while at the same time he was an expander and enlarger of the Church's thinking. He held high the magisterium, the traditional and comprehensive teachings of the Church, and yet as a writer he restated Church truth in a way that seemed not crabbed or merely reflexive, but loving, expansive, and new. He was a crusader for religious freedom and freedom of conscience. He was a bearer of a universal message to a world he saw as broken into many different and particularized cultures, each of which, he said, took its shape from different aspects of man. He was a transformative individual who steered the ancient church into the 21st century. And he was a prophet. That century, he said, would be overwhelmingly religious or overwhelmingly not, but it would not be lukewarm. In this, he was echoing the mid-20th century French philosopher and public man André Malraux. John Paul was the most traveled pope in history, an apostle pope bringing the message of Christ all over the world. He was the best-selling Holy Father in history, too, in terms of books and CDs. You could even buy CDs of him praying. He was an old-fashioned man, a Slav born when the First World War had just ended and the Russian Revolution had just begun. He was born before penicillin, Lindbergh's flight, television. And yet, one of his final innovations in the summer of 2004 was the daily Vatican text message, in which he shared his thought for the day with anyone with a cell phone or a BlackBerry. He enjoyed getting email at johnpaul2@vatican.va. He was a child of the 20th century, an Eastern European, which means he knew how to suffer. He learned early. The country he loved and was born into was enslaved by two different and yet similarly brutal gangs from 1939 to 1989, which is to say for most of his adult life. He pondered the fact of suffering in human life for many years, asked for illumination from God, and came to conclude and later write in a papal encyclical that suffering, quote, seems essential to the nature of man. It is not random, he said. It is not simply a matter of accident, and it is not avoidable. Suffering, he said, gives us a point in time in which man is, in a certain sense, destined to go beyond himself. With that suffering comes always the opportunity, quote, for rebuilding goodness in the one who suffers. As a personality, he was even-tempered, not much given to highs and lows, had what he called a happy temperament, but there was about him always a sense of powerful internal control. He was often humorous, not often jolly, sometimes dry in his wit. Father Richard John Newhouse, the editor of the magazine First Things, told me once that when he visited the Pope in Rome, they joshed with each other. "How do you josh with a Pope?" I asked. Father Newhouse said, "Well, he's very ethnic. He's very Polish. He finds it funny that I'm German." They used to make jokes about it. Father Newhouse said, "There was something that had gone very well one day. I mentioned it, and the Pope said, 'Pretty good for a Polish Pope.'" Once, when Father Newhouse, a New Yorker, visited the Vatican, John Paul asked him, as he always did, about the health of New York's cardinal at the time, Cardinal O'Connor, who was not well. Father Newhouse told me. So I said, "Well, you know what Cardinal O'Connor said to me the other day? He said, 'When I get up in the morning, I pray that I'll just go to bed that night without having discouraged any impulse of the Holy Spirit.'" So I said, "Holy Father, isn't that a beautiful thing for him to say?" And the Pope sort of grunted and said, "Yes, very beautiful, very beautiful. But then I told him that." He loved to sing. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of Polish songs. He hummed when he was in a good mood. He liked to recite poetry, and he used to do it while climbing mountains. Once, during that clamorous first visit to Poland as Pope, the Krakow crowds wouldn't let him go to sleep. They massed around the Archbishop's residence in the dark, and they sang to him and they called for him. The new Pope came out and said, mock sternly, "Who is making all this noise?" They laughed in response, and in the laughter he told them he couldn't speak anymore because his throat was sore. Then he sang with them for a while. Finally, as midnight came, he acknowledged their demand that he speak. He said, "You are asking for a word or two, so here they are, my friends. Good night." Later, at a mass in another town, he pointed out toward the Tatras Mountains, and he told the crowd of young people that when he had been made Bishop of Krakow, he had asked his superior if he could still climb the mountains, and he was told yes. But now, he said, as Pope, it was no longer possible. So the crowd yelled to him, "Then stay with us." And the Pope laughed and said, "It's too late. Where were you on the day I was made Pope? It's just like Poles to try to close the barn door once the horse is gone." When he came to New York for the first time, the mayor, Ed Koch, showed up to greet him. He said, "Your Holiness, I am the mayor." The Pope looked at him and said rather puckishly, "I shall try to be a good citizen." At a church in Germany, at the end of a particularly effective homily, which culminated in his quoting St. Paul, the crowd interrupted him again and again with applause and cheers, and he teased them. He said, "I thank you on St. Paul's behalf." On his pilgrimages, when his airplane would cross the international dateline, he liked to tell reporters traveling with him, he'd like to say this with a straight face, "Ah, now we must decide what to do with the extra day we have been given." When his doctors would busily confer in a large group outside his hospital room after he'd been shot, he would refer to them as the Sanhedrin. He would say to his aides, "What did the Sanhedrin report to you today?" Once, as he recuperated after he had been shot, the Pope told the officers of the papal household that he would like a pool to be built at Castel Gandolfo, the papal summer residence. It would be good for his health, he said. He needed to exercise. But his aides felt a certain amount of consternation over the request. They said, "A pool will be very expensive." The Pope listened, and then he said, "Electing a new pope will be even more expensive." They built the pool. He met once with a bishop who'd gained some weight. The bishop reported with some pride that his diocese was quickly expanding. John Paul laughed and said, "So is the bishop." After his hip replacement surgery, he began to walk with a cane. Sometimes he twirled it like a vaudevillian. Once he pretended it was a pool cue. He had the natural talents of a diplomat. He tended to diffuse situations and give something to both sides in an argument while not budging from what he believed to be true. When the American bishops wrote in favor of a church-wide declaration of bias toward the poor, John Paul said, yes, the poor need us. Although, of course, we must remember that it is not helpful to divide people by class and reduce them to representatives of one socioeconomic group or another. All people, he said, are individuals and individually deserving of love. And then he moved the conversation on. When interviewed by reporters on his airplane, Shepherd One, on the way to Central America on one of his first trips as Pope, John Paul was pressed on a subject that was roiling the church at that time in the 1970s and 80s. He was asked, "Is it legitimate for Latin American Catholics to choose socialism?" His reply was, I think, a small masterpiece of soft toughness. He said, "Well, we have to begin to study what socialism is and what sort of versions of it there are. For example, an atheistic socialism, which is incompatible with Christian principles, with the Christian vision of the world, with the rights of man, with morality, that would not be an acceptable solution." But he was asked, "What about socialism that recognizes religion and guarantees its rights?" His reply, "Ah, there is a lot of talk always about guarantees, but you don't get to see them till later. You don't see the guarantees until after the fact." He left the reporters to ponder that, and he went on to other issues. One night on his first trip to Poland, tens of thousands of young people marched to see him. They had just done something spirited and brave. They had rescued a big cross that had once stood proudly at the top of a building of the Jagiellonian University. The government had previously torn it down. Now the students were carrying it in their hands. They asked the Pope to bless it, and they made it clear that as soon as he did, they would march back to the university and put it back in its place of honor once again. John Paul knew the government police were watching. He knew they were ready to move at any sign of unrest. So he blessed the cross, and then he told the students not to attempt to erect it, not to provoke the authorities. They were abashed, he could tell. So he joked with them until they were laughing, and the moment was diffused and a potential crisis averted. In all this, one senses paradox. So very confident, so modest. A man born into humble circumstances who was not at all destabilized or shocked to have become the most famous man in the world. A man of pronounced views and pronounced patience. A man who used his body all his life for joy and who accepted with equanimity his eventual inability to control that body. He believed so fully that God hears us, responds to us, intervenes in history, gives us what we need. And yet John Paul worked and struggled as if everything depended on him. He was extremely questioning and extremely faithful, a natural prober and thinker who naturally believed.